I assure you we will not let this happen again, Mr. Camden said to Daisy. Fitzroy, get that window repaired this morning, and we will require a watchman here at night. No point in waiting for the official opening.
I'll add them to the payroll, offered Sarah.
I'm very sorry, sir, said Fitzroy. You should be.
Mr. Camden glared at him.
The press and the rest of the city are waiting to see the Dakota fail. A scandal like this would have ruined us before a tenant steps foot inside. Right, sir.
The man looked every one of his 60-odd years.
Mrs. Smythe, let's speak in your office.
Mr. Camden dismissed the others. She followed him inside, shutting the door behind her. He paced the small room.
Again, my apologies for the intrusion. It pains me to think I was here the entire time, but wasn't able to come to your aid.
We are fine, and I have no doubt Fitzroy won't let it happen again.
As a father, the thought of a strange man roaming the halls and breaking into Daisy's room is abhorrent.
His protective nature toward his family touched her, but a small sizzle of jealousy flared underneath. She liked the idea that they were friends, and having his family around would no doubt change that once they arrived. What an awful, selfish thought. She vowed to be more generous. He placed his hands on his hips and lowered his chin.
I'm afraid I must ask a delicate question.
Yes?
Does Daisy need a doctor?
Sarah breathed deeply. I don't believe so. The girl insisted that he'd only been in her room for a minute. I believe she was unharmed. Mr. Camden looked away, embarrassed.
I am glad of that. In any case, if you do think there's any need for further help, I hope you won't hesitate to reach out to me.
Of course not. She wondered if he still remembered his offer to go into town for curtain fabric. She'd been looking forward to seeing more of the city. Even now, the odor of the dank pigsties wafting in from outside reminded her how far out into the hinterland she was. Mr. Camden stood to go, but paused at the door.
And let's not forget...
Yes?
The housemaids will be arriving this week. Are you prepared to get them settled?
Of course. I've already assigned them rooms and plan on conducting an orientation.
Excellent. And for the trip into town, shall we meet at the front gate at 10 o'clock?
He'd remembered. She smiled, then tamped it down. It was a trip to town, after all, nothing to be so excited about. A similar excitement had very nearly ruined her years ago, while in Mrs. Ainsworth's employ. And she had remained wary of the ulterior intentions of men ever since. Yet in the intervening decade and a half, she'd proved uncanny at detecting the cur among gentlemen, and Mr. Camden seemed to fall into the latter category.
Very good, sir.
To Sarah's delight, Mr. Camden arranged for an open landau for the journey, which meant she could view the city without obstruction. Her gaze swiveled around left and right as he pointed out various mansions along Fifth Avenue below the park. He ordered the carriage to stop at 52nd Street.
Behold the masterpiece that made Richard Morris Hunt the most sought-after architect in New York.
Sarah gasped out loud. Is this a house for one family?
Not just any family. The Rutherfords. Mr. Stafford Rutherford and his wife, Mrs. Alma Rutherford.
The pale limestone, littered with a multitude of gables, balconies, and finials, seemed to shimmer in the sunlight, rendering it like a mirage compared to the earthen-colored buildings nearby. The structure resembled a doll's house that had been grossly inflated, as if at any moment it might burst through the severe iron gate that surrounded it. It belonged on a mountaintop in Europe, not a crowded city street. The design was so ostentatious she almost laughed out loud.
I'm not sure where I'm supposed to look, said Sarah finally.
There are 4,000 millionaires in the city, every one of them trying to top the other. I call the current movement European wedding cake.
I have to agree. It's awfully loud.
He smiled down at her.
Like the Dakota, no.
The Dakota is rather busy as well, I must admit. But it's a showpiece, and I assume that's what the tenants want. If they can't live in one of the Fifth Avenue mansions, why not take up in a building even bigger and fancier?
What kind of house would you like to live in, Mrs. Smythe?
No one had asked her anything of that nature before. Flustered, she couldn't answer right off. Indeed, she had never imagined living somewhere other than the London bedsit, or her Dakota garret. Her place of residence had been secondary to her place of work. Always. I like my current lodgings perfectly well.
That's not what I asked.
What would you design if you could do anything, and not have to answer to Mr. Hardenberg or the Mrs. Putnams of the world?
You're dodging the question.
He gestured for the driver to go forward. Very well, then. I suppose a cottage in the country, with a small garden. That would suffice.
Not at all. I won't have it. If you had all the money in the world and could build anything you wanted, here on Fifth Avenue, what would it look like?
To think that this is what you do all day, come up with designs. I admit, I haven't the faintest idea. Certainly not a Richard Morris Hunt mansion. I'd get lost on my way to breakfast.
He let out a guffaw that pleased her.
I will draw you a house. How's that? Once all the chaos has calmed down and the Dakota is moving along smoothly, I'll draw you something. Even if it's a thatched roof cottage that reminds you of home.
She looked away. Home. As soon as she received her first paycheck, Sarah would send half of it back to the cottage at Fishbourne, with a short, cheery note, assuring her mother that all was well. Hopefully that would alleviate the guilt at having moved so far away. But she knew better than to expect a letter of thanks, or a return letter at all. Not from Mum. By the time the carriage made it to Grand Street, Mr. Camden had pointed out the many ways the city had changed during the past several decades. From the weathered wood shacks that dated back 100 years, to Federal-era brick dwellings, and finally the chocolate brownstones that now dominated the side streets. They passed the Academy of Music, where members of New York's high society gathered for a taste of culture, and a rustic Gothic revival church on 20th Street, where they prayed. Mr. Camden was the only man in the fabric shop, other than the store owner. But he didn't seem to mind. Together, he and Sarah examined silks and damasks, but he dismissed both as too heavy and unwieldy.
I know Mrs. Camden will want to hang something like this when she arrives, but for now I simply need something to block out the harsh rays and still let in light.
How about this? Sarah pointed to a tea-colored sheer.
That will do nicely.
He gestured to the shopkeeper who came running over. When do you expect your family to arrive? She asked as the fabric was wrapped in brown paper and string.
Sometime after opening day.
He gestured back to the shelves stacked with a rainbow of fine material.
Now you must pick out something for your own windows.
No, indeed. My windows have shutters and they'll do fine. She ran her finger over a spare piece of black ribbon that lay on the counter.
Here you are, doing me an enormous favor, and I must return it. How about this?
He pointed to an exquisite, finely woven white lace.
Oh, no, sir, I couldn't.
I insist.
She couldn't help but imagine how they would look in her windows, waving in the breeze when she woke each day. She bit her cheek to stop from breaking out into a beaming smile and thanked him profusely as he put her back in the carriage bound for the Dakota. Mr. Camden shook his head.
No need to thank me. I'm still making it up to you for saving my daughter's life. Now I owe you a second debt for putting off Daisy's attacker. I figure you're a good one to have in my corner, and I'll do whatever it takes to keep you there.
How different Mr. Camden was from the other men she'd encountered at work. He needed no assurance that he was powerful, the way Mr. Birmingham at the Langham had. No tests of loyalty. He seemed to simply enjoy her industriousness, as well as her company. His words stayed with her the entire journey home.
Chapter 9. New York City, September 1985. Once the workers left, Bailey spent an hour examining the apartment and the architectural drawings of the renovation. True, it was mainly cosmetic, but most of Melinda's ideas consisted of either stripping off the original details or covering over them, remaking the place into something else entirely. While change was well and good, there was no way around the basic configuration of the place. Skinny hallways, huge expanses of great rooms, a nest of smaller ones clustered around the kitchen. The bones of the place screamed tradition, not Barbie Beach House. But it was Melinda's money. Usually, Bailey was able to keep her mouth shut when a client wanted something that she found to be outrageous and in bad taste. Obviously, the truth had begun squeaking out over the past few years, fueled by her drinking, culminating in her massive verbal slapdown of Mrs. Ashfield Simmons and her half-wit daughter. But for some reason, the idea of giving the family's Dakota apartment a major facelift really irked her. Bailey's own grandfather, Christopher Camden, had spent his childhood in these same rooms after being taken in as the ward of Theodore Camden, the celebrated architect, and his aristocrat wife, Minnie. Bailey had never really known her grandfather. He died when she was a baby. But she felt a curious sort of pride in the Dakota apartment because of his history here. It wasn't a sense of ownership exactly. She understood her place too well for that. But it was something. Bailey's father never said much at all about Grandpa Christopher. Bailey got the impression that he was a crusty sort when her dad was growing up. Not what you'd call a warm or involved parent. A man from a different era, with a different way of thinking, who left home at the age of 15, joined the Navy, and ended up fixing cars in New Jersey. On the way to each pilgrimage to visit Sophia and the twins, Bailey's mother would question her father about what exactly happened back then, only to be met with a couple of shrugs at best. The fact that Grandpa Christopher had completely cut ties with the Camdens was absurd, according to Peggy. Surely, there must have been some kind of mistake or misunderstanding. But maybe Bailey's grandfather wasn't interested in living the same way his foster parents did. Maybe he thought the rest of the family were terrible snobs or something. If so, Bailey's sentimental attachment to the Dakota was sadly misplaced. Perhaps the Camdens were so mean to Christopher, an outsider, when he was a kid, that he would have loved to see the place trashed. Like Bailey, Peggy had been enamored of the building. She would enter the Dakota courtyard wearing big sunglasses as if she were a movie star, even on the cloudiest day. But Bailey knew they were mainly for hiding her sidelong glances into the dizzying array of dark windows that surrounded them, hoping to catch a glimpse of one of the famous inhabitants. How excited Peggy would have been to learn that Bailey was not only working, but living in the building. A cold sweat made Bailey shiver. Even though it had been years since the accident, the thought that her mother's physical being no longer existed, or no, it did exist, and even worse, was buried in South Jersey's sandy soil, still gutted her. Bailey made the long journey down to the East Village, collected her two suitcases, and unpacked back at the Dakota. It took all of 3 minutes. Luckily, she'd stashed most of her belongings in her dad's basement in New Jersey before moving into the ex-boyfriend's cramped apartment, which had probably kept them from being pawned off during her stint at Silver Hill. Not that she needed much at the moment. Her stomach grumbled. Halt. God, she had been conditioned. It was more like brainwashing than substance abuse counseling. Avoid being hungry, angry, lonely, or tired if you want to stay sober. Well, she was all four when it came right down to it. She stood in line at a pizza place on Columbus and then wolfed down a couple of slices back in the apartment's library, where a ratty folding table had been set up to review plans. She really should find an AA meeting nearby, but it was getting dark, and she didn't feel like wandering around without having a better idea of the neighborhood, which streets to steer clear of, which were safe. Tomorrow, for sure. A scratching noise up in the ceiling caught her attention. Mice, most likely. What a field day the critters must have in this building, with its thick, horsehair-stuffed walls and 3 feet of mud between each story. Plenty of room to make nests from which to make forays into the residents' kitchens and feast on crumbs. The thought was weirdly comforting. The mirror on the opposite wall reflected her image back to her. At 30, after a decade of hard living, the skin around Bailey's eyes had lost the baby smoothness of her teenage years. But lately, her face had begun to fill out as the hollowness of addiction disappeared. Without alcohol and drugs, she'd started eating again, hence the 2 slices of pizza. She'd always thought her hair and eyes to be unremarkable, brown on brown, her mouth too large. As a young girl, people often asked her if she was about to cry when she was just lost in space, thinking about something, minding her own business. Her mother had liked to say she had a kind face, whatever that meant. Bailey pushed her hair behind her ears. God, that perm. Never again. She sat back and looked about her, her gaze settling on the spot where Theodore Camden had been murdered. Poor man. Struck down in his own home. She hoped his ghost wouldn't come back and haunt her for the destruction of his property. Bailey walked back to the kitchen, tossed the pizza box into the trash, and reluctantly stepped into her tiny room. In the darkness, it was no longer cozy or reminiscent of Silver Hill. It was the servant's apartment, where the kitchen maid, or whoever, had made a tiny life by serving other people, and then probably died after she was no longer of use, with no pension, no security. That would not be Bailey's fate. She had her wits about her now, her mind no longer clouded with toxic substances. The cot creaked beneath her as she lay flat on her back, exhausted. After being abandoned in her teens without any guidance at all, she had been shown a world of pleasure and fun by Melinda, and it had been a wild ride. But no more. Bailey had veered toward a dangerous precipice the past few years, and now she had an opportunity to straighten herself out. The jarring sound of the doorbell woke her the next morning. Bailey opened her eyes. A soft gray light came through the window of the room. Her watch said it was 7 o'clock. Too early for the workers to be here. She pulled on her jeans and threw a sweater over her t-shirt. Hold on, I'm coming. The ringing became incessant. For God's sake. She unlocked the door and swung it open. An elderly black man stood before her, wearing suit pants, a crisp white shirt, and purple bow tie. Deep creases lined his forehead and cheeks, and the pouches of skin below his eyes drooped, lending him a sleepy air. Yet his carriage was that of a far younger man, tall, upright, and broad-shouldered. He didn't look happy. Can I help you?
I hope you can. I live right below you and water is streaming down from the ceiling of my bathroom.
Bailey rushed to the bathroom in the master bedroom. The workers had yanked out the grand claw-footed bathtub the day before in order to replace it with some monstrous hot tub. A dripping noise came from the floor.
The pipes must have broken, said Bailey. I'll call my guys right now and get them here to fix it.
You bet you will.
Bailey sighed. What had she gotten herself into? The plumber agreed to come right over after Bailey phoned him. She reluctantly trooped back down the stairs to tell the other tenant and realized that she didn't even know his name. He answered her knock, his mouth set in a firm line. Bailey had dealt with angry residents in adjacent apartments during other renovations. It was standard practice in New York City to piss off at least 2 out of 4 during a renovation. "Hi, me again," he raised his gray eyebrows. "The plumber will be here in an hour, and he'll figure out what's wrong. I've turned off the water, so at least the worst is over."
"You think so?"
"Yes, I do. Is it all right if I take a look at your bathroom? That way I'll be able to figure out which tradespeople to call to put it back in order."
"You may."
He opened the door and let her in. The apartment was one of the smaller ones, but with the high ceilings, it really didn't matter. Especially as almost every inch of wall space was covered in framed paintings from multiple eras, a joyful, abstract pop art inches away from a stern, 19th-century portrait. The Victorian sofa and chairs were loaded with mismatched throws, while rugs of all sizes and colors zigzagged along the floorboards. The effect was dizzying, like being inside a spinning kaleidoscope.
"I'm afraid I didn't get your name."
She held out her hand. His grip was soft, his fingers long and delicate.
"I'm Kenneth Worley."
"Bailey Camden. I'm the interior designer slash owner's rep for Melinda Camden. Pleased to meet you, although I'm sorry it's under these circumstances."
"As am I."
The ceiling of his bathroom looked like a wet diaper, with enormous bubbles of plaster threatening to burst through at any moment. Water stains marred the wallpaper, a gorgeous pattern of wild roses, and obviously antique.
"God, this wallpaper is ruined. I'm so sorry."
"Yes, it was put up in the Roaring Twenties. I'm guessing I won't find its replacement."
Although his voice stayed even, she detected a faint sense of panic behind the words. He blinked a couple of times. Was he on the verge of tears?
"No, sir, you won't. But I will find something as similar as I can, or I'll draw it on the walls myself."
She was half joking, but he seemed to take her seriously, giving her a nod of his head.
"I take it you know Melinda well."
"I do. We're related. Very distantly." That was the best way to put it, probably. He surveyed the room, as if memorizing it, then turned to her.
"I need a cup of coffee. Would you like one?"
Bailey nodded and followed Kenneth into the kitchen, uncertain where she stood with this man. From what she could tell, the layout consisted of a small bedroom, a living room, and the kitchen tucked back on the other side of the dining room. All the period details remained intact, the cherry floors and fireplace gleaming as if they were encased in ice. Along the top of the kitchen cabinets, he'd arranged a dozen colorful cookie jars. "Your home is lovely," she said. "It's obvious you've taken good care of it."
"Unlike Melinda upstairs, who's dismantling the place from what I hear each day."
"She's not dismantling. Well, maybe she is. But it's part of a new look." Kenneth poured her a cup of coffee and one for himself.
"Sugar or cream?"
"Neither. I think I'll be needing it black today."
"You will. Look, I know I sound like an old grump, but Melinda's no different from the rest of the new generation. Or most of them, anyway. No respect for the history of the place."
"I have to say I agree."
"You're just a young girl. What do you know about history?"
"I know that they called this the Dakota because it was so far away from the rest of New York at the time."
"And you would be wrong."
A sly smile appeared on his face. "That's not true?"
"Not at all. The owner, Edward Clark, was enamored of the American West, and hoped to name everything on the west side, including the avenues after territories and states. Luckily, he was overruled. So instead of the ghastly moniker Idaho Place, we have West End Avenue. The story you refer to was mentioned in passing during a press tour on the building's 50th anniversary as mere speculation, and took on a life of its own.
His eloquence and knowledge delighted her. I stand corrected. But I do know that Melinda's great-grandfather helped design and build this place. I keep wondering what he'd think of her redecorating plans. She took a sip of coffee. It was strong and delicious. How long have you lived here?
I came to work here back in the late 30s.
You worked here?
As a butler, right before the war. After that, they began letting in the artistic types. Lauren Bacall, Leonard Bernstein, Rosemary Clooney. It was a fun place to work. Even if the snooty old guard were unhappy with all of us throwing parties, having a gay old time, literally.
It must have been wonderful. He shrugged.
I wouldn't go that far. I may own this apartment, but that doesn't mean I belong. Oh, three or four of the old housekeepers and nannies were tucked away in studios on the ninth floor after their shelf lives expired. But I lucked out. My dear boss, Oscar. Of course, everyone knew we were shagging, but no one spoke of it. Left me this place in his will. All gloriously mine, so I could die in peace, other than Sophia Camden's disdain whenever we passed in the courtyard, and the fact that my bathroom is now wrecked.
Bailey could only imagine the outrage Melinda's mother and some of the other longtime residents had directed Kenneth's way at the very idea of a servant turning shareholder, taking over an entire apartment as if he were their equal. I promise you I'll make it look as good as new, or as old. She got a smile out of him at that. The coffee was taking over her brain, making her feel a nice buzz. Honestly, waking up to a strong cup of coffee was a better drug than any of the others she dropped over the past decade. You must have seen so many changes during your stay here.
More than you know. This place used to have a tenant's dining room, down on the main floor. Though the food got less interesting after the war, and they eventually closed it down. By then the tailor had moved out, as had the laundry and maid service. No one valued what a special place this was. In the 60s, I remember, before it became a co-op, you could rent a 17-room apartment with 6 bathrooms and 8 working fireplaces for $650 a month.
Bailey found her mouth watering at the idea. A half hour later, the plumber, a stocky guy with a thick Polish accent, arrived. He prodded the ceiling and shook his head.
"This'll take a couple days,"
Kenneth sighed.
"I shall wash up in the maid's bathroom until then."
Bailey put a hand on his arm. "Thank you for being so understanding. Once it's fixed, I'll have my contractor stop by and we'll discuss the plaster and wallpaper."
"I trust you to find a replacement wallpaper, if you like."
"Would you? I'd be happy to do so." Bailey knew exactly which vendor in the D&D building, the wholesale resource for every designer in the city, would have a similar pattern.
"In the meantime, I want to see Melinda's apartment, so I can get a sense of how much history you're destroying."
Upstairs, Kenneth ran his fingers over the woodwork like a lover as Bailey led him through each room.
"The craftsmanship still blows my mind."
"Melinda wants a clean look, which means tearing all this down. I have to admit, it kills me to have to do it."
"You know you can save it."
He had her full attention. "How?"
"You can put it in storage in the basement. They have the original elevators down there. Lots of crown molding and fireplace mantles. You name it. Then, in 30 years, when the pendulum swings back to appreciating a traditional look, the new owners will be able to replace what was lost.
I'm so happy to hear that. It makes me feel less like a tyrant with a wrecking ball. I'll talk to the super and arrange that.
Yes, you'll want to talk to Renzo. He's part of the Dakota Mafia as well. His father was super here for practically his entire life, until he passed away.
I haven't met Renzo officially yet. Melinda seems to want to avoid him.
He can be a bit testy. You should make sure to bring your game face.
Why's that? Kenneth shrugged.
We've had a spate of unfortunate, and by unfortunate I mean hideous, renovations of late, and he's wary of outsiders.
She was doomed. I'll treat him with kid gloves. They were interrupted by a knock on the door. She recognized the super from the quick peek she got of him out in the courtyard with Melinda. Renzo had arrived. He looked Bailey up and down, which was a thoroughly unpleasant experience. He wasn't looking at her like a man checks out a woman, but as if she were some alien from Pluto.
I hear you've damaged the riser.
He looked to be in his late 30s. His strong Italian name didn't match his gray eyes and fair hair, which hung just above his shoulders. The hippie look was long gone, but he seemed to have missed the news. Bailey held out her hand. Good morning, we haven't been introduced. I'm Bailey Camden. He held up a dust-covered hand, palm out. She withdrew hers.
I was in Kenneth's apartment, ripping down the ceiling. Aren't you the sweetest?
Kenneth swooped behind Bailey.
Bailey and I were just discussing the fabulous wallpaper she's going to put up to replace the damaged one. The one in your apartment was from the 1920s. Not sure how you're going to find an equivalent.
What an ass. Here she'd solidified what she hoped was a little bit of goodwill from an unfortunate situation, and the super was stirring things up again. I'll make sure Kenneth is taken care of, that the bathroom is fully restored. I've already assured him of that. She couldn't help herself. You seem to be more upset than he is at the moment.
I am. If this is the way your contractors plan on carrying out the renovation, the cosmetic renovation.
Right. I'm new to this project, so bear with me as I play catch-up, but I believe they filed an amendment with the Department of Buildings last week. The leak might have happened whether or not there was construction going on. The building is over 100 years old, after all. He cocked his head.
Where's Wanda?
My firm has taken over. I'm the new owner's rep.
Does the building management know?
Since I just took over yesterday, no. But I'll phone them today and give them all my information. Kenneth touched Renzo lightly on the arm.
She's a good egg, Renzo. Don't be so hard on her. Look, show her the storage room so she can save some of the loot from the reno. She's on our side, you'll see. Fine. I'll be in my office in an hour.
Renzo studied Bailey again.
Tell your contractors to salvage anything they can.
Bailey took the elevator down to the basement at the appointed time. The lowest level of the Dakota was bright, with well-lit hallways and a fresh coat of paint on the walls. The area directly under the courtyard was mostly open space, other than an office built off to one side that had a large glass window. She knocked on the door.
Come in.
The room overflowed with newspapers, green industrial filing cabinets, and cardboard boxes. But Renzo sat at a grand desk, an antique from the looks of it, made of ebony and elm. The harsh fluorescent lighting accentuated its incongruity, like a sapphire in a puka necklace. On the wall opposite,
was an oak cabinet, the doors wide open, displaying tools of every size and shape, small and large drawers, cubbyholes and shelves. A masterpiece of design and utility, everything in its place. This was a man who prized his wrenches. She'd win him over with flattery. "That's a beautiful desk," he shrugged.
"A lucky hand-me-down from a former tenant."
"And what a cabinet. Did you design it?"
"My father did."
"Stunning. Do you do woodwork as well?"
"I used to, but there's no time these days."
He looked annoyed. She'd overplayed it. Bailey made a mental note to ask Melinda for $100 to hand him when she saw him next, as a way of greasing the wheel. The cost of doing business in Manhattan. Until then, she'd have to tread carefully. "You were going to show me the storage unit for the apartment?" He rose and grabbed a huge keychain from his desk.
"Follow me."
They turned down a passageway with doors on either side, every 5 feet or so, like a prison. Renzo stopped in front of the one marked 45 and found the key. He unlocked and pushed it open. Inside, a bare light bulb hung from the ceiling. He pulled the chain. The space was empty, except for a stack of dusty tiles piled up in one corner. Bailey shook her head. "I won't be able to store everything in here. It won't all fit. Melinda's taking down the mantles, the molding, everything."
"Why?"
She was unprepared for the question.
"Because her taste sucks? And yours doesn't?"
She hadn't realized how close they were standing. He smelled like wood chips and grease. Not a bad combination, surprisingly. She'd market it as man smell, the cologne. The thought made her smile. Renzo rubbed his eyebrow with the inside of his wrist. The veins on his forearms were thick, a faint purple blue.
"It's not funny, what's going on. A new shareholder on the fifth floor tossed out everything before I could stop them."
"I heard you were able to keep the original elevators. I'd love to see them."
"Three of them were taken in by tenants. One's become a sitting alcove. Another tenant combined two to make a bar."
"That's thinking outside the box. And the fourth?"
"Gone. It disappeared."
"How can an elevator disappear?"
"Not sure. During my father's reign. My guess is one of the contractors realized its value and stole it, but no one was held responsible."
A loud noise rumbled through the basement, like an earthquake. Bailey looked up in alarm.
"Just the subway. Although, sometimes I do hear screaming at night."
He was trying to scare her. Bailey shrugged. "I assume a place like this has lots of ghosts. So much tragedy inside these walls."
"We don't discuss that. Not with outsiders."
"I'm not exactly an outsider. My grandfather was raised here. He was Theodore Camden's ward." "There's another tragedy for you. Another murder. Almost like the building's cursed."
"You have no idea what you're talking about."
He looked like he was about to lock her in the storage room and leave her there. She'd told Kenneth she'd handle the guy with kid gloves, even if he didn't really deserve it. Talk about prickly. "Sorry, I didn't mean to overreach." She stepped out of the small space. "Is there somewhere else you'd like us to put everything?" He led her to another locked door. She'd become disoriented and was no longer sure which side of the building they were on. The room was all interior, no windows at all. He flicked on the light switch and she caught her breath. It was a catacomb for the glorious detritus of the Dakota. 4 claw-footed tubs, dental molding, mantles, baseboards, dozens of massive mahogany pocket doors. Her eye traveled over piece after piece, some in fine condition, others nicked and scratched. An old chandelier sat on top of a beat-up grand piano, and a trio of trunks were piled up in the far corner. "This is so sad. Like the land of the forgotten toys."
"At least we know things are safe here."
He pointed to the trunks.
You can have your guys move those into the alcove to make more room. But you'll need to supervise your workers both coming and going. I don't want to find anything missing.
I'll make sure everything goes smoothly.
Like earlier, at Kenneth's?
She'd had enough of his smugness. You know as well as I do that when renovations happen in New York City, things break. I've offered to make it right, and to be honest, I'm not sure what else you expect me to do. I can't change my clients' tastes. This is my job. This is how I make money. His lips parted as if he was about to say something. But instead, he slid the key to the room off the key ring and placed it in Bailey's palm.
Give this back to me when you're through.
He turned and walked away, leaving her unsure if they'd reached a detente or if she'd simply harangued him into submission.
Chapter 10. New York City, September 1884. Sarah awoke early the day after the trek into town and headed downstairs to the tailor's room. The Singer sewing machine was one of the latest models, with ample room for cloths on the walnut cabinet and a smooth, shiny shuttle. She placed her feet on the treadle, gave the shuttle a whirl, and the machine clattered into action. The years away from a sewing machine had taken their toll, and at first the work took longer than usual. She couldn't help but worry that Mrs. Camden, with her fine upbringing, might make fun of the curtains when she eventually saw them, laugh with her husband at the sight of such simple window dressings. Eventually, the fabric slid under her fingers with ease. Once finished, she folded the material into a large square before working on her own. On the last hem, the thread bunched up, creating a small bird's nest on the underside of the fabric. As she concentrated on rethreading the machine, a shiver of memory ran through her. Rose-colored silk, smooth under her touch. Mr. Ainsworth, standing behind her, placing a large hand on her shoulder. How the strength of him was palpable, and how her heart had beat faster at his praise. He'd taken his hand away quickly, but then came more touches, more familiar, lingering ones that she squirmed under. "Mrs. Smythe!" She jumped, pricking her finger. Luckily, the fabric remained unstained. Mrs. Haynes stood in the doorway, her thick eyebrows giving the unfortunate effect of a perpetual scowl.
"Yes?"
"Mr. Camden asked for you. He's in his apartment."
"Thank you."
She stood and gathered up her work. "I've made him some curtains to keep out the sunlight. He's probably eager to receive them." Why was she explaining? Mrs. Haynes was not her employer.
"Right, ma'am."
Always a cipher, that one. Between Daisy's chattiness and Mrs. Haynes's reticence, at least her charges balanced each other. To her disappointment, Mr. Douglas was with Mr. Camden when she entered the library, the finished curtains in her hand.
"Ah, good, Mrs. Smythe."
Mr. Camden looked at the cloth in her arms, confused.
"Your curtains?"
"Right, yes. Leave them over there on the windowsill."
"Of course."
She put them down on a chair to the side of the window. If he opened it, the dust from the roadway might dirty the cloth, but he didn't seem to care about the curtains. In fact, all of the familiarity of the previous day was gone from his demeanor. He barely looked up at her as he and Mr. Douglas ran through a list of items with her to be taken care of before opening day. A vague frustration settled over her, but she shrugged it off quickly. Her job involved keeping the tenants happy, and Mr. Camden was a tenant, not a friend. Best to remember that and not overstep her official duties. When she finally finished up her work for the day, she retreated to her tiny room, where the setting sun cast a reddish glow. She hung her lace curtains and marveled at how they prettied up the place, made it sweeter and cozier. Daisy knocked and peered in.
"You in for the night?"
"I believe I am."
"Curtains! How lovely!
Daisy walked to the window and ran her hand along the delicate folds.
Where did you get them?
I made them.
You're quite handy, then.
I've sewn a frock or two in my day. She wished she'd had enough fabric to make two sets, as Daisy, such a young girl, ought to have something nice to look at. Daisy draped the material around her head.
When I'm married, I'm going to hang gold velvet draperies in my windows, the better to show off my scarlet Worth dress.
What a lovely tableau. But you'll need to find yourself a very rich husband in that case.
I plan on it.
Her blue eyes twinkled.
Did you hear that Mrs. Stuyvesant Fish had elephants in the ballroom at her fancy dress party? Guests fed them peanuts as they waltzed by.
I didn't realize elephants could waltz. Daisy giggled.
No, silly. The guests did the waltzing.
Such excess. Sarah crinkled her nose.
But such fun.
I hope you'll be able to stay focused on the building, with opening day coming along. Daisy nodded.
Of course.
She didn't want to be too hard on the girl, not after the trauma of the man in the night. But Daisy was a dreamer. She'd managed similar types at the Langham, especially among the pretty girls. Good night, Daisy. The sun disappeared over the horizon and drew Sarah back to her window. Part of her envied Daisy's hopefulness. The girl had a grand plan. And wasn't that why Sarah had come to New York City in the first place? Sarah's grand plan involved running the Dakota according to the expectations of her employers. And while her gray bombazine silk was a far cry from a gown of seed pearls and antique lace, it would certainly do. One mustn't get carried away.
Quickly, unlock the back gate.
Sarah shoved the key into Fitzroy's hand.
There's a line of moving wagons on 73rd Street waiting to get in.
Fitzroy squinted down at the metal key in his hand, as if unfamiliar with the whole concept.
But it's only 7 in the morning. No one's supposed to be here for another hour.
Let them in. We can't keep them waiting.
She'd risen earlier than usual, knowing that a smooth opening day was crucial to the future reputation of the Dakota. If chaos ensued, the building and its management would be written off. Already there had been snide remarks in the press about the class of citizen who had signed up, that they were of a lesser sort than established society, wondering why anyone would choose to live in the hinterlands amidst squatters' sagging homes. Fitzroy skittered off. They were a sad pair, she had to admit. She knew nothing about this job and was learning on the fly, while poor Fitzroy was far too old for the demands of his position. His hip had given him trouble lately, and his lopsided face was sure to disturb the ladies. Now this. Her meticulously scheduled agenda for the day was already in ruins. 65 families had rented out apartments, and of those, 30 were to move in today, while the others would file in over the course of the next week. She'd enjoyed having the full staff around during the past few weeks, the maids doing a final cleaning and the electricians fiddling with wires. Even the tailor, elderly and rather deaf in one ear, turned out to be a fine man, assuring her in a loud voice that she could use his sewing machine in the off hours whenever she liked. The order that had been barely established was about to be turned on its head. She'd seen Mr. Camden only in passing recently, as they both rushed from one corner of the building to another. But his demeanor remained serious, as if their jaunt downtown had never happened. A few minutes before 11, Sarah retreated to her office to catch her breath. As she'd been inundated with questions and concerns from the tenant's staff for the past 4 hours. Although the servants' rooms in the apartments were enormous by any other standard, she'd had to shut down squabbling about which maid got which room in apartment number 36, and barely prevented the new resident housekeeper, Mrs. Quinn, from giving the butler in apartment 32 a tongue-lashing when he complained about some invisible grime in the parlor.
She was used to juggling two levels of help at the Langham. The guests, maids, and valets, who generally expected to be treated as royalty, and the hotel staff, who put up with their airs but talked about them behind their backs. She could allow no animosity like that here. No one would be checking out, hopefully, and the hierarchy had to be carefully maintained. Daisy rushed in, breathless. Tendrils of blonde hair fell along her white neck. Beautiful, but not acceptable.
"Fix your hair, Daisy."
The girl caught her breath and then shoved her hair back into place.
"The residents are here, Mrs. Smythe."
Dread washed over her. "But they're 2 hours early." The plan had been to get the tenant's staff and room settled before allowing the actual tenant's entry. She'd imagined greeting them as they swished down the halls, opening their front doors and exclaiming aloud at their gleaming new homes in perfect condition. Daisy shoved a piece of paper toward her.
"There was an error on the letter that went out. It says 11 o'clock, not 1 o'clock.
"Daisy, you typed this for me." The girl stuffed her hands into the pockets of her dress.
"I'm sorry. I didn't realize I'd hit the same key twice."
A critical error, but still. At least you got the date right. 2 hours. She had to stall them, keep them occupied. Otherwise they'd chime in with opinions about what should go where and which way to arrange the dining room table, and the day would never end. Or they'd decide the place was uninhabitable and move out before they'd even arrived.
"What's this I hear about the residents coming early?"
Mr. Camden stood in the doorway, fuming.
"There was a miscommunication," said Sarah. "We'll take care of them."
"We spoke about this, Mrs. Smythe. How important it is that they enter a well-run, elegant apartment building. From what I can tell, it's a madhouse on every floor."
She'd be sent back to London on the next ship if she didn't fix this fast. Mr. Camden was absolutely glowering at her. She turned to Daisy and spoke with clipped vowels.
"Get the cook and tell her to put out some champagne in the dining room. I'm going to the courtyard to round them up. I'll take care of this."
The last sentence she directed at Mr. Camden.
"If you would come with me, I would appreciate your assistance."
Thankfully, he did as he was told, although she could see him clenching and unclenching his fists as they stepped outdoors. Indeed, a line of broughams encircled the two fountains, and after the footman helped off the ladies, Fitzroy moved the vehicles out and brought in another round of carriages. The residents were milling about, unsure of where to go.
"Why isn't my personal staff here to greet me?"
demanded a stout lady in a black beaver cape. Sarah stood on the stone base of the southern fountain. Using her natural height to her advantage, she called for everyone's attention.
"I am Mrs. Smythe, the managerette here at the Dakota, and I would like to welcome you to this magnificent building. Please join me in the dining room for a champagne toast to your new home, followed by a tour of the highlights of the Dakota by Mr. Camden, one of the architects of this stately, modern apartment house."
As she'd figured, the word champagne perked them up. She led the way into the south entrance and was relieved to see that the cook had done as asked and set up a marvelous array of delicate glass coupes and champagne nesting in ice buckets. While the bottles were uncorked and poured, Sarah eyed the room, Daisy at her side. Daisy leaned into her, disappointed.
"They're not the upper crust of society. The papers were all saying that no one of Mrs. Astor's set would be caught dead living here."
True enough, the tenants' names were unlikely to overlap with Mrs. Astor's list of acceptable society members. Certainly not Mr. and Mrs. Gustav Schirmer of the Music Publishing Company, or Mr. and Mrs. Solon Vlasto, who were moving downtown, not uptown, from 92nd Street. "I've seen enough of high society at the hotel in London. Believe me, you don't want to have to deal with that set."
"But they're the ones with the power in the city. It's in the newspapers every day. Everyone here is so ordinary. Dry goods and woolen merchants, that sort."
As they're paying $3,000 a year for a 10-room apartment, I would think that's far from ordinary. Perhaps you'd be happier working as a maid for Mrs. Astor. Daisy didn't answer. Mr. Camden appeared, checking his timepiece.
How long do you think you can prevent them from storming their new apartments?
Sarah lifted her chin. Follow me, please. She sidled up to one of the new residents, Mr. Camden trailing in her wake. Mr. Shermer, how are plans going for the printing plant? Mr. Shermer smiled, quite pleased.
Very well, Mrs. Smythe. Thank you for asking. We hope to have it running in the next year or two.
Of course you must know Mr. and Mrs. Steinway. She turned to the right and drew them into the group. We are so lucky to have true music aficionados among the residents. Mrs. Steinway threw her fur over one shoulder. We will create our own private village here beside the park, shan't we, Mrs. Shermer? What a lovely way to refer to the Dakota. Sarah offered up a subtle smile, one that suggested agreement, without being overly familiar. I was just saying to Mr. Camden here that the uptown rural landscape is much better for one's health. Mr. Shermer spoke up.
I consider this to be my ode to Magellan, heading into the northern frontier, weapon at my side.
What exactly is your weapon, dear? Asked his wife.
Why, you, of course.
Mr. Camden chuckled, playing along beautifully. The atmosphere tinkled with laughter and heady conversation. I dare say I like this idea of having cocktails before luncheon, Mrs. Steinway said to Mr. Camden. Will that be a regular occurrence?
If that will please you, Mrs. Steinway, of course.
The traces of Mr. Camden's irritation with Sarah disappeared as he made a subtle bow. A man with a thick mustache stepped over.
I say, as members of the FFDs, this is a bang-up way to begin our communal living experiment.
While the group gaped at the impolite intrusion, Sarah spoke up. Mr. Tatum, what a lovely thought. The first families of the Dakota, no?
On the nose!
Never mind that he'd been using the term in his correspondence with Sarah, where he'd inquired weekly about the size and number of water closets in his apartment. Commodore, we're honored to have you on board. The group closed in on itself, and Mr. Camden guided Sarah away.
Commodore, Mr. Camden murmured.
Mr. Tatum is the head of the New York Yacht Club. I've been reading the society columns religiously since I arrived.
Clever girl.
Once the last drop of the champagne had been downed, Mr. Camden led the group on a tour of the public rooms on the ground floor, the basement level with its amenities, and then up to the roof garden, where the clear day offered a view 20 miles in all directions. Finally, the group splintered off to their own apartments, the ladies walking with a slight sway to their step, and the men whistling under their breath. The Dakota was officially open. Chapter 11. New York City, October 1884. The wind threatened to blow her away, but Sarah stood firm on top of the roof of the Dakota, holding on to the metal railing. Opening day had been a success, thanks to the champagne toast. In fact, the alcohol had lubricated more than the throats of the tenants. It had eased the transformation of the building from one that was under construction to one that was up and running, teeming with life. She'd finished up the day by meeting with all of the tenant staff, making sure they understood where their duties ended and the buildings began. And so far she'd seen no bruised egos. Before climbing up to the very top of the building to get some air. The roof garden looked out over Central Park, with its picturesque castle and lake in the distance. Although the sun had set, the glow of gas lamps lit up the pathways that carved through the trees.
Mrs. Smythe!
Mr. Camden sauntered toward her. He carried the afternoon edition of the newspaper in his hand, and drew up beside her, his eyes twinkling with excitement. He unraveled the paper, not easy with the breeze, and read aloud.
"Probably not one stranger out of 50 who ride over the elevated roads or on either of the rivers does not ask the name of the stately building which stands west of Central Park."
A corner of the paper blew loose from his grasp, and she reached out and held it taut while he continued.
"The name of the building is the Dakota Apartment House, and it is the largest, most substantial, and most conveniently arranged apartment house of the sort in this country. An astonishing geographic and architectural landmark, the Dakota will undoubtedly be known as the address of New York's West Side."
"How wonderful! You must be pleased."
"I gave the reporter a private tour last week, but he was tight-lipped the whole time. I couldn't tell if he was impressed or horrified. But here, look at the headline."
She glanced down and followed his finger, which tapered to a curved, elegant tip. "One of the most perfect apartment houses in the world. That's brilliant.
Mr. Douglas will have a waiting list for years to come."
Mr. Camden's boyish excitement made her laugh.
"You've done it," she said.
"We've done it."
He closed up the paper and tucked it under his arm.
"I don't know how I would have managed earlier today. It would have been an angry stampede of FFDs without your quick thinking."
He looked down at her.
"Sorry to disturb your stroll on the rooftop, but I was walking across the park and saw you."
To think that he was able to recognize her from so far off. A breeze played with her skirts and she patted them down.
"Shall we sit out of the way of the wind for a moment?" he inquired.
A bench beside the enormous gabled roof protected them from the elements. Sarah tucked the loose strands of her hair back into place. "What shall you do next, now that this project is finished up?" He leaned back and stretched out his legs.
"Hardenberg has me already assigned to a new building, all the way downtown. But in another couple of months, I'll be starting my own firm, thanks to this newspaper article and Hardenberg's backing."
"I'm sure it will be a great success. You'll probably be quite happy to have Mrs. Camden and your children back in town."
"Of course."
Silence fell between them. She struggled to fill the space. "Where did you study architecture, Mr. Camden?"
"I was on a scholarship at the Hasbrook Institute in Jersey City, where I first met Hardenberg. When he got an early commission from Rutgers and asked me to work for him, I jumped at the chance."
She admired the way he'd forged his own path. Part of her had hoped that by coming to New York City, to America, she would do the same. But she lacked his brash confidence. Her mother had done her a disservice, constantly reminding her of her blood connection to nobility, while at the same time cursing her bastardy. She didn't know where she belonged. But it had made her good at her job. She could tell people what to do and sound authoritative, even if underneath it all was a fear of being discovered, found out, a fraud. In some ways, her natural reticence, her refusal to get too close or to let someone know who she truly was, had decreased since she'd arrived in the States. Being thrown into the lion's den of the Dakota, among strangers who didn't know or care what her parentage was, had toughened her up a touch. America seemed to be a more open, forgiving place. She didn't want to go back into her shell. He stared hard at her. A warmth spread up her chest and neck. The blanket of evening, a cerulean blue, was creeping across the sky from east to west. She looked up. "Funny how I thought I'd be pressed in on all sides in New York. Yet here I am, surrounded by vast views and an even vaster sky.
Makes the people down below seem like ants."
Mr. Camden pointed to a man who wobbled along the pathway below them.
"Ants on bicycles.
I imagine it's difficult with six legs."
"Have you ever ridden a bicycle?"
Sarah Sarah nodded. I grew up in a small village on the southern coast of England. My mother bought me a used one to run errands and make deliveries. She didn't mention the times the boys threw rocks at her as she pedaled furiously by, calling her and her mother unmentionable names.
We should go for a ride in the park sometime. Will you join me?
Before she could answer, he jumped in.
When is your day off?
Not until Saturday afternoon.
Very well, Saturday afternoon. I will supply the bicycles, and you wear your best riding outfit.
Shall I bring a crop? She asked with a grin.
Two, as I'll need one myself.
As they entered the doorway back into the building, he held his hand out to assist her in stepping over the small curb. Before he let go, she thought he gave her hand a quick squeeze. But when she looked at him, he avoided her gaze. She must have imagined it. Or wished he'd done so. On Saturday morning, Mr. Camden left a note for Sarah to meet him at the mall in the park at 1 o'clock. The city's elite paraded along the promenade in their carriages between 4 and 5 each afternoon, and she would be sure to excuse herself long before the crowds assembled to gawk at the sight. Although it was fine for men and women to stroll together without causing raised eyebrows, it would be unseemly to be seen with a married man during the grand promenade. She'd craved his company the past few days, the way he looked at her and the way he listened to her when she spoke. Not in an intimate way, she told herself, as that wouldn't be proper. But he was a kind person, and she hadn't had many friends. He stood beside 2 safety bicycles that leaned upon a wooden bench. One of them had a wicker basket strapped onto the front handlebars.
Are you ready for an enjoyable day in nature, Mrs. Smythe?
Indeed I am. The past few days of moving in the last of the new tenants had left her exhausted, and a change of scenery would do her good. For being the 1st of November, the air was uncommonly warm, the equivalent of a London summer day. She gathered her skirts and mounted the bicycle. At first, she was unsteady, but the frame was sturdy and the tires thick. As long as she kept her focus on the black-clad figure of Mr. Camden on the bicycle in front of her, she found it easy to stay upright. Leaves from the elms planted along either side of the roadway fluttered to the ground. She crunched through the sumptuous palette of reds and golds, feeling a bit like Moses cutting through the Red Sea. Mr. Camden glided down a pathway that led to a fountain, where they dismounted before walking to a small rise of grass overlooking the lake. He pulled a blanket out of the wicker basket, which Sarah laid out carefully on the ground, followed by a fresh loaf of bread, salmon mousse, and apricot tartlets.
Quite a feast, Mr. Camden. I had the chef prepare it specially. We can't have our star employee going hungry.
Disconcerted by his effusiveness, she busied herself unwrapping a block of Stilton cheese.
Isn't this grand?
He gestured to the passers-by.
A mix of society, neither high nor low, and everyone meeting in the heart of this great city to enjoy a lovely autumn day.
It's a beautiful park, but I have to say I like the gardens of Hyde Park better. He pretended to be offended, his hand on his heart.
Why put up with those stodgy English gardeners when you have the wilds of America here? Streams tumbling down rocks, paths that go every which way. Besides, here a simple boy from Buffalo can become whatever he wants, including an architect. Not so easy over the pond.
Could Fitzroy work his way up to become a man of your station? I rather doubt it.
I doubt Fitzroy could find his shoes in the morning if his wife didn't put them on his feet herself.
She laughed. You're being unkind. He's a delightful man.
He is. But I'm talking about opportunity. That's what we have. You must admit it.
You have it, perhaps.
Do you not think you could move up in the world?
His lack of awareness astounded her. Of course a woman could not move up in the world. Not the way he had. It's easy for you to think so, but there are very clear delineations, here as well as in England.
What would you do if you'd been born a duke's daughter, then?
Caught off guard, she almost spilled her lemonade. He sat up.
I've hit a chord, it appears.
She shouldn't say anything. Keep quiet as she'd done for years and years. But his inquisitive look told her she wouldn't be able to divert his attention. Not that she